So we're trying to wake ourselves up and the mask of a role, which I hope that some have brought this week, but for sure, all of you are going to bring next week, because it's the trigger and the whole works. You know, no matter how complex a DNA sequence is, there's a trigger. You know what the trigger in the DNA sequence is? It's the last little code. It exists of three codons, which ends the sequence. Every single DNA sequence ends with the same codon, end of message. And that's the trigger that makes this whole genetic code happen in a biological way. And you got a cell. Without the codon at the end saying end of sequence, everything is still suspended, still held. What more is there to come? And so consciousness with integrity to life has to say, this is it. Make it. Print. Print. So next week is the print trigger. End of sequence. Whatever you have, then bring it, do it, and then let it be. You may not be able to do it the first time around. Don't worry about that. But the important thing is to just go through it, to continue as if you had done it, to continue having the experience of being in a situation where it was in fact really done. Because later on, if your consciousness is not ready now, you will remember it as really having been done when you're matured to the point of being able to do that. You will remember that, oh yes, indeed, that was in fact done. That was in fact the case. This is the way. I'm going to read just a few words from Wright, and then we'll take our break. This is, again, the sovereignty of the individual. He's talking about architecture, but he's talking about it in this protean way of a new sense of person pulling the trigger and being made. And he will say of such people that they were like flaming souls. He writes, since a previous article written in endeavor to state the nature of the faith and practices fashioning this work of mine, I've had the privilege of studying here in Italy the work of that splendid group of Florentine sculptors, painters, and architects, and the sculptor painters and painter sculptors who were also architects, Giotto, Masaccio, Mantegna, Pisano, Brunelleschi, Sansovino, Bramante, Angelo, Michelangelo, Leonardo. No hard and fast line was drawn between the arts in their epoch. Some of the sculpture is good painting. Much of the painting is good sculpture, and craftsmanship was everywhere excellent. In all lie patterns of architecture. Where interfusion of the arts is not confusion and importunate, it is amazing. To attempt to classify work severely as pure painting, pure sculpture, or pure architecture would be quite impossible, even if desirable for educational purposes. Be this as it may, what these noblemen of Florence absorbed from their Greek and Byzantine and Roman forebears, they bequeathed to Europe as kernel of the great Renaissance. This bequest, if we deduct Gothic influence of the Middle Ages, has constituted the soul of academic fine art upon that continent and in England to this very day. From the flaming souls of these brilliant Italians were lighted the myriads of souls of the French and German and Spanish and English and many other lesser flames. They flourished, flickered feebly for a time, some to smolder in sensuality and the extravagance of later periods, some snuffed out, extinguished and banal architecture like the Rococo, or the nondescript structures such as the Louvre of the Louis and the Paris Beaux-Arts. But the legacy was truthful and real, and when someone was able to master it all, to catch fire from it, like Frank Lloyd Wright, he was able to grow into the full maturity. And by the end of his life, he was designing the kinds of buildings that will be built in the 22nd or 23rd century. Buildings like the Monona Terrace project that won't be built for at least 200 years. Designing the mile-high skyscraper in Chicago that won't be built until the middle of the 22nd century. It's just a kind of a quality that when the protean individual comes to his newly transformed integrity with a new scale, he has gotten this, like a child, from the parents of the last people who were full in their time. And that's the way the golden chain of Homer, as the metaphysical way of describing this, forges a new link. Or in the Egyptian way, this is the way that Re illuminates in the darkness a whole new realm to be populated with the this's and that's of those people who will make them and require them at that juncture. It's the eternal, motionless radiance of truth seemingly illuminating in a subtle, esoteric move, a new realm, which was hitherto in darkness, but now is light. That's the religious way of describing this. The personal way is that you find a new consciousness. You begin having the experience of opening up inside. Opening in the sense that suddenly you're regarding yourself in feeling tones and in thought ways that you had never entertained before. It's a feeling of fresh air. It's a kinesthetic quality of opening. It's the psychological insight that, whoa, this is a whole new me. I haven't seen myself like this before. And the first feeling tone that comes with that is the acrid one, before there are any kind of compromises with this world. The first feeling tone is one of grateful, loving kindness. Thank you, Lord, for this day, for this new day. That kind of a quality. If you're in meditation or prayer or contemplation, soon after it happens, you can pick that tone up. It's just pure, like the bell that we use to come back from the break. It's a pure, fine, high tone, feeling tone, quality. It's like the old shaman who recounted to Joseph Campbell his experience at the age of 8 of being left out with 4 days' supply of food, being left for 30 days alone out in the tundra. And when he told Campbell, Campbell thought he had misheard him, and he said, asked for clarification or repeat. He said, what did your inner voice tell you? And the old Siberian shaman said, he told me not to be afraid. You don't have to be afraid. That's what he told me. Let's take a break. I'm trying to get us out of here by noon so that we can have some food. And I told Mr. and Mrs. Hall that we would come over to their home about 1 o'clock. And we'll get a chance to see this mandala that most of you are chipping in to help get reframed. Mr. Hall's chipped in his $5, you'll be glad to know. His eyebrows went up a little bit when it was only $5. But there was a deep look of democratic understanding when he realized the snowshoe force of everybody chipping in, how wonderful that was. So he'll be in fine form. He's like an old Hollywood star, is always ready to go when there's an audience. So we'll go over at 1 o'clock. So I want to get us out of here by noon so you can have your lunch. If you're looking ahead, if you're following what's happening here, there are a couple of books for you to pick up. The book that in 2 weeks we're going to use as an interval between art and history is Rilke's Sonnets to Orpheus. And there are many different translations of it. Any of them will do. So pick yourself up a copy of Rilke's Sonnets to Orpheus. And the second one, pick yourself up a copy of The Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. Now, if you pick up Rilke and Franklin at any bookstore in town, they'll be sure to talk with you. That's quite a combination. And if you add Thucydides to that, you'll probably get into an argument. Thucydides' Peloponnesian War. The best edition of that is the Little Penguin Classic. Now, if you're not able to muster up enough energy to follow the whole thing, at least get the Sonnets to Orpheus and by Rilke and Franklin's autobiography. If you're looking way ahead, in about a month and a half, we're going to get to Jacob Burckhardt's The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy. The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy by Jacob Burckhardt. There was a modern library edition of it for many years, and there must be 100 different editions of that. And if you're ready for a real long look, the last book in the history we're going to use is Albert Schweitzer's classic book, The Quest for the Historical Jesus. Which as a book is like Euripides' Bacchae. It's the book that broke the back of European consciousness when it came out in 1910. That was it. That was the trigger. That was the little codon that said end of message. That was the end of European civilization. That's why the First World War is the beginning of a new era. It's the chaos of a new era. The First World War, the Second World War, the Third World War are all one war. Like any kind of catastrophic thing, it comes in pulses, like a heartbeat. It's all one war. So we have all those, and they should be available and around. And we're going to continue, if some of you are following the year-long thread here, in reading in our Canterbury Tales, or in the Odyssey of Homer. So if you haven't got those already, you probably don't need to get them. You would have got them at the beginning of the year if you were going to get those. I will try, now that I have a program on the computer, I will try to get this two-year course with all the emendations typed up in a fresh copy with all of the emendations, and then hand it out to you sometime in July. We're going to have a lot of new people come in the 1st of July. There have been a lot of people who have, one way or another, counted themselves out of the situation. And so there's room for some new people to come in July, and they've been waiting for an opportune time. And now that there's some space, they'll be able to come in. I try and keep this limited to about 20, more or less, without making a big formal thing about it. So that's coming up. So those materials. What else? If you've thrown your $5 in to help on the Marie Hall thing, getting that reframed, there's a birthday card to her up here that you can sign. And on June 25th, I'll give her the card, and hopefully on that day I'll be able to go down to Chinatown and pick up the reframed mandala and give it to her as her birthday present. I'm going to give the Sunday lecture at PRS on that day, so I'll do that in the afternoon. I think that's all for messages. Let's come to your art. Where are our paintings? Let's bring out what paintings we have. Let's start with Toshi. This is the color scheme from your new place.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And the background kind of makes itself like, you know, the sunrise, and then the flower really bursting into its full maturity.
My eye keeps returning to the center of it. No matter where it goes, it keeps coming back to the center. So I find my perception weaving in and out from center to wherever it's going to go. And it seems to make no difference where it goes, but it always comes back to the center for another stitch.
Mine too. It's like looking at a mandala.
Yeah.
Then you have the five irons, it's the five green either leaves or stems and leaves.
Toshi, turn it upside down once. Let's just for a second, if we can. Thank you.
Now the flow is a little bit different. It's still, for me, it's still the center, but I feel as though I'm being pulled up to the upper left, but I want to go back down to the center.
I get the sense that upside down now it's approaching, whereas its other way it was receding. Let's turn it back down and see if we can. Or so she is more mobile. Back where the way it should be, the way you have it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the way I painted it. That was at the bottom when I was doing it. The painting this morning.
Yeah, the center of the flower seems to be contained in that, where the other way around doesn't seem to be as in the center. It's almost.
This way it looks like a flower, the other way it looks more like a tree to me. Whereas now it's more of a flower with this tree. I also had that same response to coming in and out. It seems to be very attracted to green.
To the green in the painting?
In other paintings, there's been some green that goes to first. I think of it as Viriditas Gloriosa, a blessed green statement.
Let's
see what happens if we put a, if we look at it in terms of left and right. Sometimes it doesn't make that much difference. Dan had to leave, did he? It would seem that the right side dominates. So that the one quality that seemed apparent at first, which was a kind of a Rorschach quality.
That's what I was going to say.
Is not true.
I see it as a Rorschach type, even though it's not symmetrical, but I see the horizon going across. As though the bottom were a reflection.
So that if we turn it 90 degrees and put in a center divider, we should be able to observe an effect. Is that right? How now?
It's much more symmetrical.
Oh, yeah.
My eyes. It's much more like a Rorschach.
I don't know what a Rorschach is, but it looks like a heart.
Rorschach was a psychologist who would make an ink splotch on paper and then fold the paper twice so you get a complete double.
The heart. The heart.
Yeah.
I saw it as an Eastern mystic go of the new life.
Did you paint it right-handed or left-handed?
Right-handed.
You're right-handed.
Yeah. You see the left dominance in it. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can see that tilt is 90 degrees, and we'll take this away so that the full effect comes. You can see that tilt at 90 degrees is really the full dynamic of this work. So that yeah, the full symmetrical dynamic of this work occurs in a vertical mode and not in a horizontal mode, whether the way you painted it or upside down. So that in this particular work, turning it 90 degrees was the effect of new angle of vision. Remember, in all the other work that we've had, if we turned it upside down and either didn't make a difference or made a difference which was integral to the work, here it was rather extraneous. But turning it 90 degrees was effective. So notice that in your aesthetic analysis, you have to take a kind of a quaternary overall view, not just up and down, or left and right in terms of up and down, but you have to be able to rotate it. Now, usually you can't turn a painting around like that, so you have to do it with your eye visually. You have to turn it around in your mind, usually. You can't go into the Norton Simon and look at a Rembrandt and grab it off the wall and turn it. But you can do it in your mind. Yeah?
I noticed thinking about what Tracy said about the fullness and the maturity. And yet, and the center for me reminds me of this, the center of like more seeds, more little pods, or like an embryo.
As if the center green were seeds of more blue to come. Is that what you're thinking?
That's
my thought, yeah.
And so it's like there is fullness, but yet there is
more to come. Continuing fullness.
look at paintings here, then I find my eye just finding something in the room that's similar and then just sort of dwelling on that, you know. And then just now I just find myself looking at this pillow, which I guess has so much similar colors, and I'm thinking of the Last Supper somehow. I'm thinking of all the apostles or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, and just at the table and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it has sort of similar colors, but I mean, I wouldn't be doing that if...
I better give that cushion to Toshi. Toshi, that's yours. It matches your color scheme, and it definitely belongs to you. Well, that's true, Ed. That's exactly right. But you notice that as we talked aesthetically about the eye, my perceptual eye weaving the center into the work, your perceptual eye is weaving the painting into the very situation. The learning situation, the room that we're in. And so it's an interesting amplification. What else, Toshi? What else should we know? Does it have a title? Untitled.
Morning Awakening.
Okay. Let's look at this for just a second with the title now. Morning Awakening. Not Evening Awakening. Morning. Morning Awakening. Now the first associative thing comes to my mind is Morning Glories, which are that color. The leaves of the morning glories from which further blossoms come. She's taken the color of the leaves of morning glories and put it in the center of this. So it's as if it is true that more blossoms are going to come from those leaves. And so this is a morning glory. The sky is, I think, never that color in the morning. So that this is a morning glory against a man-made structure, a wall. And pink is characteristic of Spanish Southern California Mediterranean style architecture color. So I'm thinking in those terms there. So really, Toshi, it seems to me that this is your morning glory. Aspiring.
Toward the sun.
Yeah, ascending. Yeah, going towards sun. Yeah. Whereas when it was on its side, it finally was disclosed to be off balance because the aspiration was going askew, going to one side, going mainly to the side of the hand that was making it. Whereas when the work in terms of its own dynamic was presented rightly, outside of the context of its genesis, it disclosed that it had an inner aspirant movement which was, you know, characteristic of its own integrity. And in this way, a work of art is born from us and is free. It has its own integrity. And while the artist is still working on something, has full say over the work, when it's finished, then the work has a say about itself. Same thing like a parent and a child. When a child is freed, emancipated, it has its own integrity. He or she has their own integrity. No longer subject to the parent. Notice that this is not only true culturally, but it's true psychologically. And if the parent, as a parental image, still has an effect on the child, one way or the other, then they've been finished. Almost everyone you meet, incidentally, is unfinished in this way in our culture. It's an unbelievable situation. does not preclude relationships of any kind, but there's no possibility of any existentially real relationship until there's first emancipation and freedom. Notice that dragging out the transformation process is a real deleterious situation. To be in love with transformation is to be very foolish about life indeed. Transformation is something to get through. So like an artist, you have to know when this is enough, when this will do. And you pull the trigger and you say, end of message, and you get somewhere. The idea of an ongoing transformation is being a kind of a personality, clever and supersonic, that one can live with, is itself an image of Maya. And so the never-ending transformation ideal is an illusion. It's ruined a lot of good people in our century. A lot of the lure for drug experiences comes from this unconscious, the subconscious desire to have an ever-changing personality, because that's what's in. That's part of the medical assessment of situation. So we can go a long way away from this work. Notice, where was the line? Where was the line of talking about this work and the amplification? When we looked away from the work to our mind. When I looked away from this work to my mind, then I began to see the amplifications, the implicitness, the lessons that can be drawn, the insights and so forth, when I looked to my mind instead of the work. Both are valid, but one has to be conscious, what am I now doing? Part of maturity is to be able to know, on request, to ask of oneself, what am I now doing, and to get a straight answer, as they used to say in the 40s. And if your being cannot give you a straight answer, or gives you a straight answer and you don't hear it, then you have to recognize that now I've got a problem with communication. It's just as simple as that. Now I have to learn how to listen and learn how to be able to hear the answer to just such a fundamental existential question as, well, what am I now doing? Am I looking at nature? Am I looking naturally? Am I looking at something artistically, like in a psychic energy expressive mode? Or am I looking at a mental amplification of it? And there are not like an infinite series of these kinds of options, but they are patterned very, very definitely. And they fall into two general kinds. They fall into processes and they fall into stages. And what we're doing here on Saturdays is just acquainting ourselves with the stages and phases, which are classically characteristic of our fullness, of our being, of our life, so that we at least have some kind of a glimmer. What is there to know? What's the full table look like? So that in my own way I can have at least a fighting chance to come to terms with as much of it as I can. Let's try one other painting. Donna, could you bring one? Let's
Isn't part of that amplification when you consider naming it?
Yes.
The name?
Yes, uh-huh, naming. Let's leave Toshi's up, and then if you would, up to one of those chairs, would they do?
not yet decided whether to title it Omarama, April 11th, 1986, or Losing My Sense of Wonder. Briefly, the story behind this painting is that as a little girl in the second grade in St. Louis, Missouri, we had a weekly science program on the radio, and one week I was in the second row out of two rows, you know, we gathered around the radio, and we had a program about the constellations in the sky and the myths, the ancient Greek myths, of how these stars got there. And I was totally captivated. And my parents encouraged me, and I studied in my fashion, you might say, mythology, and was interested in astronomy. In those days, I didn't, you know, did not know about astrology. But it was not an interest that I actively pursued, but I always retained an interest in astronomy. The mythology sort of fell by the wayside. A couple of years ago, when we started getting, you know, the media rumblings about the reappearance of Halley's Comet, I, on the spur of the moment, decided to go to the Southern Hemisphere on the day it would be the closest to the Earth, and the Southern Hemisphere was where it would be, according to all the media reports, the most visible. So that's how I wound up in Omarama, which is approximately midway, top to bottom, east to west, of the South Island in New Zealand on April the 11th. And it was not a prepackaged tour, but once I got to Omarama, then the tour kicked in, and they picked you up at your hotel around the area and took you to a sheep field where the farmer had, you know, rented his field for the evening for people like me who come from all over to be there to see Halley's Comet. And there was just a crowd of people there. They had some telescopes set up. And there were some very knowledgeable people. I never did find out who they were, who was standing there explaining. This was a large Magellanic cloud. This was a small Magellanic cloud, et cetera, and so forth. And it was just a beautiful crystal evening. I never did see Halley's Comet. And people were asking where Halley's Comet was. And it seemed to me, as you loosely stand around and experience these things, and most of the other people gathered there eventually caught on to where Halley's Comet was. But to this minute, I don't know. But I, you know, I enjoyed being there. And now, why did I lose my sense of wonder? Because my whole interest in astronomy, which is ebb and flow, began as a little girl in St. Louis. And I met a man who was picked up from the same motel I was, and we were picked up in the middle of the night. And we were waiting for the bus to come and pick us up and take us to the sheep station. And he said, wow, this is American. All my life, I've been waiting for this evening. You know, when I was a little kid in Cincinnati, I'd go to the planetarium, and they said, if Halley's Comet is going to be back in 1986, you should all live so long. And, wow, this is not the evening. And so I sort of kicked in with my own memory of grade school in St. Louis, and I got to the field and experienced just what I told you, which in an odd kind of way was everything at the same time. It was nothing. But I never had a sense of wonder. Like, here I am all these years later after being this little girl and this second girl in St. Louis, Missouri. It was like I was meant to be there. And yes, I was disappointed that I didn't see the comet, but I could live with it because I was meant to be there. I just lost my sense of wonder. And it was meant to be. And this is, therefore, my representation of it. These are the background colors. I like blue and purple. This is a galaxy. And because I like the calligraphy, and my way of showing transformation is a Hebrew letter, and this is a Japanese character. This is the Hebrew letter I worked from the Kapwa, and this is the Japanese. Is it called a kuna, Roger?
I believe.
That I found to be somewhat similar to the Hebrew letter that I was starting from. Which way the transformation goes, I don't know. It was placed here in the picture arbitrarily. The characters are completely arbitrary. I don't know what this means about transformation.
bend of it.
What number is the Hebrew letter on the right? What number in the alphabet? Do you happen to know?
I don't know. I don't know if it's 17. This card is 17. I just
17, then, that's what it is. Huh? 17. 17 it is, yeah. Right. And it's a Kabbalistic image in the tarot iconography as a star. She is in an experience in the middle of the night looking for a moving star, which she does not see. What she does see, though, and is aware of, she sees the movement but not the star. And the movement expresses itself symbolically as transformation, because transformation is a movement. It's not a thing moving, it is movement. And so the painting is a painting of the exact perception of the movement, a star movement, but not the star. Not that star out there, but an inner star, which is also now currently not there because it's currently moving. But it is currently there as movement, which she picked up in the middle of the night and had enough integrity to be able to put it out, because that's exactly, because she's truthful, that's exactly what was really true about the situation, and so she expressed it, because she's not used to brooking deception in herself or anything, so she was able accurately in the painting to disclose exactly what was there. The movement of the inner star is what she did see. Yeah, I wish we had a portable mirror so that we could look at the mirror reflection. Well, from here you see the left-hand letter looks like an open mouth, the mouth open in wonder, a lipstick mouth open in wonder, as if all. Yeah, it's a phantom impression of the inner self that went onto the painting.
Right.
Because there was such intense honesty for the moment, she couldn't help but express quite accurately what was really true.
I told her, I'm here.
Told her, I'm here, I am here. I am here. Though you can't see me as a now, I am certainly here occurring.
You felt